Let's just dive in and start talking about Chopin, which you're going to be playing in this program at Villa Montalvo coming up.
Delightful subject. I've spent a lot of time with Chopin and continue to spend a lot of time, and it's a joy, but we'll get into that.
How many times have you done the complete cycle of Chopin's piano works?
I've actually done it in three places. That will take a little qualifying, too, because, you know, the meaning of the word complete is, it's like, you know, it ought to be like truth, so, you know, it's either complete or it isn't, but more about that in a moment. I've done it in New York, Ann Arbor, and Purchase, New York, at the State University in a series of six recitals. And now, to explain what I was trying to say before, was I decided for practicality to present only the works that Chopin published in his lifetime. In other words, opuses, everything for solo piano from opus 1 to 64. And obviously that means no concerti, which is a small amount, no concert pieces, no chamber music, no songs. It's a bit of an arbitrary cutoff because some of the posthumously published music is very wonderful. But Chopin's general level of quality in his published opuses is really incredible. I mean, there's just a big preponderance of A works, a lot of A plus works, and a few A minuses, and not much else. I mean, there are a couple of lesser things among the published works, but he was very severe in pruning away what he didn't want published. One is reminded a little bit of Brahms, who actually wrote pieces and then threw them out because they weren't good enough. But in the posthumous works, first of all, you'd need two more recitals to do it, and I felt that since the posthumous works include a lot of juvenilia and incidental things that were discovered after his death that he had no intention to publish, I felt that would lower the general staggering level of quality of the cycle. So it was also for practicality. I mean, Chopin didn't write that much, but still, if suddenly turns into eight recitals, it becomes less wieldy even for the presenters to present commercially.
So. And you're also recording all of these works at the same time.
Yes, or both before and after the actual public appearances of the cycle, because I've actually been at recording the complete Chopin, and this will be as complete as possible, every last note, because I think for recording is a very different experience, of course, than concerts. In a concert performance, you have the whole line, the whole musical line of the concert to think of, whereas in a recording situation, you can listen to recordings in a more contemplative or even in a research mode, so you might be curious to hear what are frankly weak works like the Fugue in A minor, perhaps, or that early Funeral March, Opus 72, number 3, I think it is, I wouldn't necessarily say they're not good music, but they're certainly weak, let's face it. And it's very interesting. When you get to know a composer in depth, you want to sort of see what they were up with, and it's nice to see what juvenilia is and what didn't get published. But that doesn't necessarily make a good performance in public.
Mm.
So that's why I divided it that way. So I actually started recording about 1990, and I still have not finished. I've left the most difficult for last, the Etudes and the Mazurkas, which are occupying me now. But once those are finished, it'll all be done.
You think of the mazurkas as some of the most difficult.
Absolutely, yeah.
Interesting.
Difficult in a different way. Every piano teacher and every musician says to their pupils, you know, that of course everything is difficult. To do anything well is difficult, and we know that, but nevertheless, the difficulty of the Etudes is standard. That's easy to explain. They're hard. They're real hard. I don't believe the pianist has been born the master of them all. I don't even know if the composer might have been. By master, I mean who could give a sensational performance of every etude. Not a good one we expect. A sensational one, well, that would be nice.
But at least you don't have to do them all in one session.
Exactly. That's the advantage of recording, too. Mazurkas are difficult in a totally different way because they are so exquisitely crafted and their moods turn on a dime. I mean, the emotional flow of mazurkas is very important, and it's also very spontaneous because although Chopin is the most exquisite craftsman, his music is filled with, invitations to the performer as well as commands. You know, for example, in a small mazurka of 2 minutes, he might present the same opening theme three different times, and sometimes he might write slightly different dynamics or slightly different phrasing in the indications of the performer. Now, You have to think in the case of Chopin, who was an improviser and a spontaneous player too, does this mean that every time I play that second theme, that note has to have that extra accent or that pianissimo? Or is it more or less a range of possibilities? You know, because we know that, like all great artists, he didn't play the same phrase twice the same way. So is it a kind of indicated improvisation? Those decisions are rather difficult. I mean, in a more architectonic composer like Beethoven, you know, if he writes a subito forte in the exposition of a sonata, and then writes a subito fortissimo the second time around, it's pretty obvious he wanted that second one to be bigger and or whatever. Very often you just know this is the point. Whereas with Chopin, sometimes you wonder, gee, I wonder if that diminuendo is really the point of this, or is that just part of the emotional flow or the available things to do? Well, I've just said a mouthful. I know some people will be puzzled by this. But
well, that brings up my next question, because is Chopin more difficult to record than other composers because of that improvisatory, spontaneous sense that you don't play the same thing twice the same way?
I would like to answer it unequivocally, yes. Unfortunately, all music is difficult to record because recording presents its own series of challenges and difficulties, some of which have nothing to do with music at all. I've recorded enough now in my life so that I'm firmly in the belief that in every single recording session or set of sessions, something is going to go wrong that has never gone wrong in anybody's recording session anywhere in the world at any time, because that's the nature of the beast. For example, I was recording the Clair de Lune in the Debussy suite Bergamasque many years ago in a beautiful-sounding modern chapel near New York City. And I started recording it. It was in December, about 4 in the afternoon when the sun was going down and there was snow outside. Well, we didn't know that in a piece that hovers on the edge of inaudibility, that the stained glass windows cool off at different rates and emit the tiniest clicks, which wouldn't have mattered 20 years ago, even with the finest equipment. But now our finest equipment is yet more sensitive, so it actually picks up these noises. So, you know, this was sort of, who would have thunk, you know? So we had to do the whole thing over again the next morning because it was all unusable. You know, and we had to wait till a time of the day when we figured. Because it took us about 2 hours to identify what were the source of these weird little studio sounds. So in January of this year, I was up at SUNY Purchase to record yet more Chopin solo pieces and sort of miscellaneous recording, which will be out soon. We lost 2 days because of the blizzard of 96, the great big blizzard in New York. So the first 2 days of sessions were just canceled, which really puts pressure on you because then you figure, well, we've got 2 more days, but I can't do 4 days of work in 2 days, so you have to reschedule, and it's complicated. But that was minor compared to the fact that once we got there, we heard this sort of distant sound. We couldn't figure out what it was. It sounded like a windstorm outside, but there wasn't a windstorm outside. This is a marvelously protected building. Well, it's a huge stage facility. It's a hall, and it goes up about, the stage works go up about 90 feet, and the storm had blown the seal on a door up there. So, of course, we heard this slight noise, which was only audible during the rests, really. The softest playing covered it. But it was enough so that it was distracting, you know, and would drive us all crazy. So we had to get that fixed. Well, that took 4 hours while they crawled around up in the things up there and, you know, dropped their screwdriver down 90 feet and had to come back and retrieve it. And then they couldn't really fix the whole thing entirely. So, you know, as I say, almost every recording session may have some major glitch, which has nothing to do with art or pianos or recording technicians or Chopin. So, yeah. And I don't want to dwell on it too long, but it is funny, you know, and I think anybody who's recorded can tell you stories like that. And it depends. It's a matter of tolerances. Then you judge, well, can we go on with this disturbance or can we not go on? We just went on, finally, because they couldn't fix that seal entirely. And we went on entirely in the few spots. It was only a few spots where it was really a bother. So we just had to do those over occasionally. So, anyway, I think I've gotten rather off track. But in that sense, yes, Chopin having implied a lot of spontaneity and needing a lot of a certain kind of spontaneity is very difficult because, how should one say, if I can just give a couple of examples, and I'll do it. These are broad examples. You know, if Beethoven in the Appassionata writes pianissimo, and you play it pianissimo, well, that's fine. And then when you have the fortissimo interruption, which comes next, I mean, critics can argue for years as to the quality of your fortissimo, the quality of your pianissimo. You can worry about all those things. The major message, though, is Beethoven's message of, in this case, a brutal contrast. I mean, Beethoven is usually more subtle than that, too, but this is a life or death struggle musically. In Chopin, it's usually rather more subtle and delicate. And, you know, you just, the third time that theme comes in the mazurka, do you want it to be a little more nostalgic or a little more fiery? All of which are possible within that piano dynamic with whatever he's written for you. So it's, well, I don't want to be too abstract about it, but it's challenging because you also need your emotional nature very much in sync. Back to Beethoven again, he's a great architect. So to use a bad analogy, Beethoven is the engine that's pulling the train, you know, and the pianist is maybe the engineer or something. Whereas with Chopin, you're driving the carriage and the horses, and it's delicate from moment to moment. It's a joy too, but it's very challenging, because the other challenge in Chopin is that he's such an exquisite craftsman that if you have all magic and atmosphere and no structure, it's not very satisfying. If you have all the structure outlined clearly and do everything the way he says it, that's critical. But if you don't have the magic, it's also nothing. It's kind of he's a tricky guy.
Let's talk about this program you're doing at Villa Montalvo. One of the pieces you're playing is the third scherzo, the C sharp minor scherzo.
Right.
And I want to ask you about the first 20 bars. One critic says that they are 75 years ahead of their time. They are keyless. The beginning is quite disintegrated tonally. Passages such as this reveal Chopin as one of the displaced persons of musical history, a 20th century composer forced by a freak of nature to wander through the 19th.
Well said. Who said that?
I don't remember.
Oh,
but
boy.
Can you
show us how it's keyless
and how it's disintegrated tonally?
Absolutely. With great pleasure. Just to place those listeners who don't spend their whole life dealing with classical music, the third scherzo was written, here's bad musicology, let's say somewhere around 1840, give or take a few years, let the Chopin scholars howl at me. In 1840, of course, Beethoven and Schubert had already written some astonishing music, including some astonishingly dissonant music. But generally, the tonal system was firmly in place, being advanced, being experimented with, expanded. Brahms was 7 years old, let's say, so that you know that what he wrote 55 years later would be no more radical than this, for example. Well, let me just play it, and I'll just even do it a bit on the slow side so you can hear what's not there. Now, this announcement of the four C sharps, which establishes without any equivocation a key, you really wonder what's been going on harmonically before it, because if you want to do a phrase-by-phrase analysis, the first phrase starts on D, sinks to B. The second doesn't even sink, it just moves voice leading-wise. So we really land on B, we land on this, and then miraculously we land on D through the same kind of slithering. And once we've got D, and then Chopin gives you the B sharp, you realize then, after the fact, you've had a classic Neapolitan, or is it German 6-5 in the wrong inversion or something. I forget what my theory is, pretty rusty at this point. That's a perfectly good setup for a C-sharp tonality. But it's very convoluted thinking. I mean, it's very indirect. It's by a master of theatrical surprise, too. This is by a master who's not a miniaturist, by the way. In this piece, he shows he's not. So it's...
People must not have known what to make of that.
I think probably not. Probably not. Of course, he has noble precedents, which were marked upon at the time. Beethoven's First Symphony started in the wrong key, which today doesn't shock us at all. But in those days, to have a key that said a symphony that says C, start that was pretty howlingly wild stuff. You know, in a way, we are charmed by that if we're aware of it. Because of the music history that's happened since, I think it's almost impossible to be shocked still by it. Chopin's example actually sounds more incongruous in his point in history even than Beethoven's does, I would say. If you also think of the finale of the second piano sonata, it's almost impossible to ascertain what key it's in or even what it's doing harmonically. It has a degree of modernity. I'll just play a couple of bars of it that bewildered absolutely everybody at its time. And, you know, if you had read that Bartok wrote this, you wouldn't be so surprised 100 years later. It's still stunning, and as a matter of fact, when it comes, its placement after the famous funeral march, which is so severe and so monotonal, I mean, it's a stunning gesture, and people always respond with an audience always responds with a kind of electricity to this wild and crazy movement, because it's so. It retains its ability to shock, because not only is its harmony shocking, but its actual spiritual content, if you will, is shocking somehow.
Now, I heard he was self-taught as a pianist. Was he also self-taught as a composer?
Yes. Who could teach such a creature? Yeah. His first teacher was Adalbert Živný, who was a Czech violinist, would you believe? So, and I think Chopin must have been about six when he studied with him for a few years. Sort of not a piano, a music teacher, you know, a music master who came to the house and gave some lessons, probably on various instruments, one imagines maybe not even terribly well. But in any case, whatever he did, he was obviously an honorable guy. And before long, Chopin's precocious genius was recognized in Warsaw. Warsaw was not Paris or London or Vienna. It was a provincial capital. But however, provincial does not mean the sticks. It was a place where a lot of music, a lot of opera happened, artists visited regularly. So there was a good level of musical culture, and he was recognized instantly. By the time he was a teenager, it's very amusing to read the annual reports of his examiners in music at the end of the year, you know, sort of about age 11 or 12. It's astonishing, brilliant, surprising. You know, we predict a great future, and by 15, surely the greatest talent this country has ever seen. And by this point, he was studying with Joseph Elsner, who was a professor, who was more of a composition teacher than anything else. But once again, take it in most simple terms, it seems that Elsner understood. Elsner was good enough and bright enough to understand what this genius was and didn't try to inhibit him too much. And in other words, didn't do any harm and taught him the basics. Gave him a very good grounding in Bach and Mozart, and those were the two composers that Chopin loved most of all till the end of his life. Without question, they were almost his only two favorite composers that he really loved and revered. He loved Italian opera, and he loved a lot of other music, and didn't like a lot of other music, but Bach and Mozart were his guys. Elsner tried to get him to write operas and string quartets and all the proper forms of music, but Chopin just wouldn't have it. I mean, he was an independent little guy, and he had a sort of uncanny self-knowledge, I would say, of his own strengths and weaknesses. He knew himself very well right from the start.
Would you say that because he learned so much on his own, that was responsible in part for his amazing freedom at the instrument?
Could very well be that, you know, in a tradition that Americans tend to identify, which is the Yankee individualist. You know, the Yankee individualist had great energy and enterprise and was not inhibited by a lot of those Euro strictures. Chopin, in a way, did not learn those inhibitions and did not have them forced on him. I don't know if they had been forced on him, if he would have accepted them anyway, because sometimes genius has its own way. Certainly, when he left Poland as a fully formed composer at the age of 20, not knowing, of course, that he wasn't going to ever make it back. I mean, you don't leave your country when you're 20 planning to die of tuberculosis 19 years later. It's not, you know, it's not. So we always see Chopin through this tragic and ill mirror, which is very true, but of course he probably didn't look at it quite that way when he was 20. He set out to conquer the world in his own way. He was a fully formed composer. He wrote many of the Etudes, Opus 10, the first Nocturnes, Opus 9, in Warsaw. So it wasn't that he went abroad and found influences which stimulated him. He was set. When he got to Paris, he was kind of the toast of the town as a new pianist, but I believe it was, whether it was Moscheles or Kalkbrenner, one of the great virtuosos in Paris, and Paris was a city of piano virtuosos at the time. The piano virtuoso was the king, sort of the Elvis, or perhaps even the Michael Jackson of the era. Anyway, they would drive
or
people wild.
Roger Daltrey in Listomania.
Yeah, that's probably a slightly better exaggeration of the fact, but the cultural climate was entirely different. When Liszt would give a great recital in Paris, the populace would carry him out of the hall on their shoulders. I mean, he'd have to do 2 hours of encores. Contessas would fight over his, used cigar butts.
And people do that for you, don't they?
Oh, of course. They just run up on stage and tear my clothes off. Sure. No, we have changed. I would not want all of what went on then, but on the other hand, a little bit of it might be nice occasionally. And I don't mean the tearing off of clothes, but I mean just the sheer frenzied excitement. But this was a new art form in those days. In any case, Chopin, by the time he got to Paris, did have a consult with one of these great local virtuoso teachers who said, oh, you're marvelous, just give me whatever it was, 2 or 3 years, and I'll get the kinks out of your playing and your compositions. Meaning the things that we now recognize as the supreme genius of Chopin probably were just offended at a more conservative teacher who offered to correct these weeds in the garden, and Chopin just didn't have any, quite wisely just didn't bother.
Yeah.
It's interesting, when he wrote his Etudes, some critic wrote that a pianist should not attempt these without a hand surgeon present, because they were so much beyond anything of that type that had been written before. They developed the possibility of the human hand. And with a very conservative old style of what was fundamentally a harpsichord-derived or clavecin-derived touch, now you couldn't play Chopin's Etudes in the old, good old-fashioned way. I mean, you would hurt your hand if you tried.
And now they would say you shouldn't do it without a Rolfer present.
Exactly, which, as a matter of fact, back to the Etudes, yes, they are still a terrible, terrible challenge to living humans. Now, and it's not that other composers, Liszt immediately comes to mind. He also wrote pieces like that, didn't he? But there's something particularly diabolically twisty about Chopin, which you really have to spend a lot of time learning. It's hard to say. I don't want to get too technical without cameras present, because you have to show some of this stuff, but...
Yeah.
Chopin developed the relationship of the keyboard and the human hand, I would say, just about to its fullest. If you can play Chopin's pieces pretty well, you are virtually equipped for almost anything that has happened later in piano literature.
The teacher, Abby Whiteside, would give all her students, I think, the Chopin Etudes and say that was, if they could do them, then they could do anything.
Yeah, and you really can. Just, I mean, with the exception of a few hammer and tongs things of the 20th century, which were not foreseen, but you can do them probably safely if you know how to play the Chopin Etudes. They're a very good guide to piano playing, or Chopin is generally a very good guide. It can be different. It can't be more difficult.
You're listening to Music of the World on KPFA 94.1 FM. My name is Sarah Cahill, and my very special guest today is pianist Garrick Olson. I'd like to thank Jim Bennett for engineering this program. Getting back to the C-sharp minor scherzo, the third scherzo, what does the key of C-sharp minor mean to you?
That's a good question. It's almost like a Rorschach test, isn't it? If I maybe just very personally reminiscenceful, the first piece in C-sharp minor I ever was able to play was the first Moon of the Moonlight Sonata of Beethoven, because I was a little kid and I was ambitious and I noticed this piece looked slow and it sounded great and I played it in C-sharp minor. C-sharp minor has always been a very dark, mysterious, romantic key for me, and a key of darkness and tragedy. So that's what it means for me mostly, and an awful lot of music in C-sharp minor has that quality.
Does the Nocturne Opus 27, number 1, also have that?
That's absolutely. It has a very... That's a real C-sharp minor piece. And it has... As a matter of fact, that was one of the pieces, one of the many Chopin pieces that got a story told to it. Chopin hated that stuff. It's worth mentioning that Chopin considered himself a pure musician. He thought music was basically about music and not about telling romantic stories. He didn't have a lot of patience with the romantic movement of his time. He didn't believe in all this synergy of literature and painting and music. And I mean, he was a cultured man, and he did not deny it, I don't think. But I don't he thought his music was mostly about itself. However, this C-sharp minor nocturne, it's fun. This got a subtitle, something Murder in Venice or Murder in the Canals or something. It has a very mysterious kind of opening, which is very evocative. Shall I play it?
It would be great, also because it has a really unusual form, I think.
It has an ABA form, but the B is, the A is extraordinary and the B is totally wild.
Yeah.
A few guideposts, it's interesting, so many of these things were so shocking at the time and now we take them easily. But, for example, what was not common at the time was the way Chopin starts this typical Chopin left hand without the melody. It's an intro, but there's no major or minor, there's no tune. And when he writes the tune, he immediately doesn't let you know whether he's going to stay in minor, go into major, or indeed wander all over the place. So sounds a bit like musicology class or music appreciation class. How extraordinary that he has a double leading tone, sharp and flat. Well, that's a technical term. It's to define this chord, once again, as in the scherzo, to cadence into it, he goes from there. That's the point of tension. It's not this, or it's... And he really... and he has the C sharp in there, too. So he has this very harsh, would have been the kind of kink that people didn't understand in those days. They would say his compositions are wild and morbid and painful. And we no longer have pain from that because so much has happened.
Well, but some pain.
Oh, there's emotional pain and there's inner pain, absolutely.
But not, you mean ear pain? Well,
it's not the kind of shrieking,
ears.
You know, we're,
yeah.
if the microphones will pardon me, we're used to sounds like this now. And we say, oh, it's a discord. Gee, I wonder what the piece is going to be like. But when you consider, once again, in the context, and of course, all art has to be taken contextually. I mean, it is self-relevant. You know, it means things in terms of itself. A chord like that wouldn't go anywhere in any Chopin piece or any music of the time. But what Chopin did was stretch the boundaries so much and point toward the future. Oh, there's indeed pain in that... exquisitely resolved. And that exquisiteness is another aspect of Chopin that got, for many tastes, really overdone. You know, the swooning. What's that famous phrase somebody made up that I like to quote? I don't know who said it. The neurasthenic young genius who dipped his pen into perfume to compose nocturnes for lovesick contessas. You know, that's this kind of Hollywood image of Chopin and this so-called effete Chopin. And that was part of the world, too. I mean, one, you know, as we rewrite history, we like to get rid of that sometimes because we think it's not noble. But that was also part of the world he was in. It was the perfume, the glamour, the white gloves. He was a fop. He had a horse and carriages. And, you know, he never touched money in the aristocratic style. His aristocratic pupils had to lay the money by the violets on the mantelpiece. I mean, it was a different world. Yet what happens in this nocturne is not only does this strange and mournful and exotic-sounding music happen, but then the middle section erupts with a truly Beethovenian fury and has a kind of almost a paroxysm of hallucinatory triumph until it doesn't, and then there are these tragic octaves plunging down and the opening comes back. I mean, it's hard to talk about music, but it's fun to try, and I don't know, would you like me to play the piece?
That would be wonderful.
I'd be delighted to.
Wonderful.
Yeah, I won't say too much about the material of the midsection. It's quite clear what goes on. It's
maybe you could tell us, is it related at all to the A? Is B related to A?
You know, I'm not sure. It's got to be, because Chopin always thought that way. We, the great analyst Schenker, held up Chopin as one of his, along with Bach, as one of his ideal models as for the ultimate unity of every cell in the music. Mm. And I have not had a thorough Schenkerian grounding, but so I'm undoubtedly it is. I don't know where it is in this piece, and I've not found it. Let me do a quick think. No, not. I wouldn't. I don't know. Well, maybe you'll have some thoughts
maybe,
on it after I play it, and maybe I will too. I would also say that its unrelatedness is perhaps what is very interesting about Chopin's sense of form in many pieces, because it seems to me that the middle section will be unrelated to the first section. But when you hear the first section after having lived through the middle section, the first section means something very different. In other words, it's not just a reprise. It's not coming back to the A part of a Baroque aria, which often sounds quite like you expected it to.
Yeah. It's like in Schubert's sonatas when he goes through something very violent and then...
Yes.
In the return, it's not just...
It's a good analogy. I think, you know, for those of you who know them, think of the slow movement of the late A major sonata, which has a nightmare in the middle of it, and the opening sounds quite different as a result. This is... I have my own pet theory, which I haven't patented, and it's not very scientific, but one of the things I've come to the conclusion about Chopin is that he's basically, he uses a lot of Baroque procedure and techniques and movements of the bass and even motor rhythms, but he absorbs emotionally that Viennese classical sonata form concept, which is, not the concept of sonata form, we all know what that is, but the fact that there is thesis, antithesis, and then synthesis, mm-hmm. because that's, as the Viennese classic school rolled along and Beethoven developed it, you don't just hear the opening. When recapitulation happens, it means something vastly different. And Chopin manages to do that in a very different context here. This is not sonata developmental, but it takes that emotional overlay, adds it to a kind of Baroque texture, combined with this incredible piano layout and this kind of singing Italian opera style. Well, that's Chopin. I mean, I don't know. Here we go. This is the Nocturne in C sharp minor, opus 27, number 1.
Pianist Garrick Olson. pianist Garrick Olson live in the KPFA studio playing Chopin's Nocturne C-sharp minor, Opus 27, number 1. Oh, that's so beautiful. The last three bars, there's so much poignancy compressed in those, that simple sequence of chords.
It's a kind of an amen cadence.
Yeah.
It's beautiful. Yeah, it's interesting in that piece. I mean, that last cadence calls up a religious association, as it were. And yet, the stuff right before it is very... an exquisite barcarolle. And yet it all fits somehow.
It all fits, and it's interesting, because if you take any one section, for instance, that con anima, it sounds like a little mazurka.
It sounds like a fierce mazurka or something.
If you take each one of those separately, you think, well, this must not fit. But he does these very seamless transitions from one to another, so that there's no moment where you feel... anything is jarring.
It's true. Separate. And it's interesting to use the word seamless, because they are seamless transitions, and yet sometimes they're quite abrupt. That little mazurka, I mean, it's got a big lead up to it, and it's prepared harmonically, and it seems emotionally gratifying and like just the right thing, but I don't know why quite. maybe it gives a certain strength to what I call that Beethovenian argument about not about so much sonata form, but kind of the emotional justification. I'm ranting and raving now. you know, Beethoven was said to have, in his sketchbook, sketched things out and crossed them out and crossed them out until they were just like a sculptor going after just the right shape in the marble, until it became, so much of Beethoven sounds inevitable. The funny thing is, in works like this, Chopin has that quality too, which is it doesn't sound like Beethoven, but it seems inevitable when that mazurka happens, you know. It just seems like you feel, you're saying, yes, it's profoundly satisfying. The other astonishing thing is that, I mean, that whole piece takes less than 5 minutes. And the mastery with which Chopin moves you through this kaleidoscopic universe of feeling and ends so satisfyingly it's one of his trademarks as well. You live a lot of life in Chopin in a short time. and if you think of one of his greatest masterpieces, something like the Barcarolle, I mean, I remember I played that for a composer once who didn't know it, and it's a 7-minute piece, and he sat back, he said, I feel like I've heard the whole Ring of the Nibelung. And it's so concentrated. I mean, it's all essence. Obviously, I'm in love with Chopin still. Isn't it weird?
You're also playing another piece, the Fantasy, which we will talk maybe about later on. And you studied with Claudio Arrau.
Yes, I did.
Who said this was one of Chopin's unique creations that show his enormous talent for condensation.
Yeah.
And I think that's... But maybe we'll talk about
that
later on.
Yes, that's very good.
let's talk a little about the... let's go on to the next Nocturne, Opus 27, number 2.
Oh, good.
But first, I think it's maybe time to say that this concert is on Friday, August 23rd. At 8 p.m. at Villa Montalvo Center for the Arts in Saratoga. And for ticket information, you can call 408-741-3428. It's at 15400 Montalvo Road in Saratoga this Friday at 8 p.m., August 23rd. An all-Chopin program by pianist Garrick Olson. Would you read the book... not the whole book, but Moscheles wrote something about Chopin's playing. This is an old book that a friend gave me recently. And I haven't marked the passage, but maybe
you can point at it. Yes. Okay. Let's see. We are living here in the fullest enjoyment of our freedom and independence, and at Leo's, where I love to make music, I first met his friend Chopin, who had just returned from the country. His appearance is completely identified with his music. They are both delicate and sentimental. And in parenthesis it says here in German, schwärmerisch, which is more than sentimental. It's, it's one of the German words that's difficult to translate, and I'm not enough of a native German speaker to give it all of its due. He played to me in compliance with my request, and I now for the first time understood his music, and all the raptures of the lady world become intelligible. the ad libitum playing, which in the hands of other interpreters of his music degenerates into a constant uncertainty of rhythm, is with him an element of exquisite originality. The hard, inartistic modulations, so like those of a dilettante, which I never can manage when playing Chopin's music, cease to shock me, for he glides over them almost imperceptibly with his elfish fingers. His soft playing being a mere breath, he requires no powerful forte to produce the desired contrasts. The consequence is that one never misses the orchestral effects that the German school demands of a pianoforte player, but is carried away as by some singer who troubles himself very little about the accompaniment and follows his own impulses. Enough. He is perfectly unique in the world of pianoforte players. He professes a great attachment for my music and at all events knows it perfectly. He played for me some of his studies in his latest work, Preludes. I played in return several things of my own. Mm. Who would have, this is interesting too, who would have believed that Chopin, with all his sentimentality, had also a comic vein? And so on. I guess that's the bulk, yes.
Thank you. Thank you.
I have read that excerpted description. It's one of the famous contemporary descriptions of Chopin, the pianist in person.
Is it true? I just have a question. Is it true that Chopin, because he was weak from tuberculosis and he played towards the end of his life apparently very quietly, is it true that subsequent generations of pianists emulated that kind of fragile tone?
I gather it's true from the reports. We don't have records going back to the 19th century, unfortunately. Would that we did. That's a big subject which I'd like to dive into, not to be defensive about, because Chopin was clearly a 90-pound weakling, and those who've seen me know that I'm certainly not. I'm a large version of a pianist. Apparently, Moscheles' description of him needing no large contrasts, no large fortes to produce his contrast, apparently that was true. He was a slight fellow, and he was ill a great deal of his life, and, you know, I mean, aside from the tuberculosis, I suppose now we'd fix him up with a Nordic track, and that would be the end of Chopin, you know, and he'd go out and kick sand at the beach or something. But, not hardly. But there was, I think, a tendency, this so-called the lady world raptures. I mean, this is very politically incorrect these days. But there was a feeling in Europe a lot after Chopin's death that this was, you know, there was something not quite manly about him, or not quite virile and bold and noble and, you know. And also he cooperated by not writing these, you know, masses and symphonies and opera. I mean, he didn't write cathedrals of sound. He stayed with his salon pieces, mostly. On the other hand, there is a story, I believe it's true. I know I'm not making it up, but I think it's not just handed down, that when he, among his many pupils, he had some who were not, you know, ladies of the aristocracy, but he actually had some who were really very talented musicians, and one of them was a pianist called Gutmann, Adolf Gutmann, a young German student, who Chopin was particularly fond of, not only because he was very talented, because he was a big, strapping pianist, and he really could play the big stuff, Chopin's big stuff, in a way that apparently Chopin would have had envied. Mm. And at one point, when Gutmann was playing the military polonaise to Chopin, he broke a string and apologized in much confusion. And the story, which may be sentimentalized a bit, is that Chopin then said, "Young man, if I had your strength, there would not be a string left in the piano when I was finished with that piece." Now, I wonder if that's true. It's a lovely sentiment. But in that very piece, you have massive, powerful piano writing, big chords, big, huge octaves, triple fortissimos, crescendos, martial fervor. So, you know, a lot of his music asks for a lot of contrast and dynamic. Now, fast forwarding, there seems to have been a lot of sick room Chopin playing, sick room style of Chopin playing. You know, a lot of fainting, a lot of softness, a lot of mush, a lot of imprecision. When you fast forward into this century of recorded pianists, certainly people, great pianists, Hoffman, Rachmaninoff, Friedman, and so on, did not employ a miniaturist palette. They were great, grand, heroic pianists. We know that Chopin admired Liszt's own playing of Chopin's etudes. He even said, "I wish I could steal from him his way of playing my etudes." And Liszt was a big, heroic pianist. He was definitely a, you know, heavyweight or Helden tenor pianist, where Chopin was a bantamweight or something. Mm-hmm. What's interesting is that in our century, pianists like Rachmaninoff and Hoffman, and then a generation later, like Rubinstein, had to fight for a non-sentimental Chopin style of playing. We now listen to Rachmaninoff and are very warmed by his structured romanticism. We listen to Rubinstein and we think this is warm and beautiful and lush romantic playing. They were considered modernists when they were young, and they were sort of bucking the trend. And they all presented a Chopin who was a great composer, you know, with no reservation, you know, to stand alongside of Brahms and Beethoven and the rest.
And also Horowitz seemed to present more the virtuoso Chopin.
Absolutely.
He used him for flair and brilliance.
He presented very much the virtuosic, the demonic, the fevered, the nocturnal, the feverish, insanely exciting, which was, of course, in line with his personality. He found those qualities in the music. All interpreters do, in fact. And it's interesting that as I was growing up, it was either this kind of feverish, nocturnal, slightly insane, but oh so exciting and slightly decadent and dangerous Chopin or Horowitz, or this noble, full of fresh air, gorgeous, big, generous, communicative sound, rational Chopin that Rubinstein presented. And I love them both, and somehow I felt the true Chopin is probably somewhere in between there. You know, I wish that Horowitz could have had just a bit more of Rubinstein's sanity, and I wish Rubinstein could have had just 10% more of Horowitz's insanity, and I thought that might have just done the trick. When I got to know great pianists from earlier generations, when you listen to a pianist like Rachmaninoff, you get the whole palette pretty well in his own way. So it's Chopin is a very, as I said, a Rorschach test. He's a very good mirror for the interpreter, and you know, to try then to find where the interpreters are distorting or being faithful. It's almost tougher with Chopin. Because you wouldn't want Chopin without that incredible element of personal commitment.
The Moscheles quote brings up the subject of rubato.
Do
you have any secrets of rubato to tell us?
It's a lifelong subject, and you know, I mean, I have to tell you, without being disingenuous, sometimes I think I don't know what it is. Mm. I'm not trying to be falsely modest. I think all humans know what it is, but how to apply it. The real problem with rubato. No, there are many real problems. Let me give you, for those who are not musicians, rubato means robbed in Italian. So, in other words, when you have 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4, you've got this prison of even marching rhythm. That's one kind of rhythm. If you want to, as they say in music, take a little time. The original word of rubato meant you robbed one note and gave a little bit of what you robbed from that note to the next note, you know, and somebody said then you sort of eventually make it up. Paderewski, when asked about rubato, said he acknowledged the morality of the theory, but he said you don't give anything back. You just take the time when you need it. Now, what does it mean to need it, though? Let me give an example of something which is a famous rubato, which I'm no authority on, but it's the Viennese Waltz. Everybody's heard the famous Blue Danube. I'm going to try to play it without any rubato, like a mechanical piano, and it's going to sound awful. Well, that's gross, but everybody knows that a waltz doesn't go that way. You know, any music lover will say, yes, but that's not a waltz. You know, so if you do some version of what have I done? I've rushed the second beat in a little bit early. I've delayed the third. I don't even know what I did. I swang with it. You know, as you dance, you don't dance a waltz like a march. You swing and you move in curves. So that's one version of what rubato is. In other words, it's a flexibility of rhythm. And the problem with us is that the musical notation is quite precise, but it, especially in that time, didn't have an easy way of communicating that kind of easy flow.
One of the pieces you're playing at the Villa Montalvo concert, I think, demonstrates the standard idea of rubato, which is that the left hand remains pretty stable and the right hand flows and is flexible and supple.
That's a tough one. You've just defined it beautifully. Now, all composers have been aware of this word rubato. It's not a 19th century creation. Mozart talked about it, too. And he said, the left hand plays in time, and the right hand plays freely, like a singer. Boy, and that's almost Chopin's, I forget Chopin's exact quote, but it's virtually the same thing.
Is rubato legal to do in Mozart?
Oh, I think it's absolutely necessary. But there are stylistic questions. Now,
you don't use Chopin rubato in Mozart?
No, I wouldn't. And of course, some people say you shouldn't use late 19th century rubato in Chopin. That's another argument, but that's getting very specific. Let me try to give you an idea of what that might be. If you have a Mozart Alberti bass, this kind of standard outlining of a chord with a melody above it, I don't know what it means to actually not play the hands together. That was a pretty bad version. It's very hard. I've practiced this a lot. I mean, this kind of separating the brain into two halves or your hands. And I find that almost, if I try to keep the left hand really rigid, I mean, the right hand always suffers. And if I try to make the right hand very free, the left hand sort of suffers. It's a kind of coexistence, I guess. The closest easy example I think you have in classical music is probably good leader singing with good accompaniment. In other words, the accompaniment has to be exquisitely tailored around the singer, and yet the singer mustn't feel that they're in a cage, and yet the singer mustn't just, you know, be in a different room from the accompaniment. Somebody pointed out, was it Charles Rosen or some writer has pointed out that probably, you know, if you hear Judy Garland sing Over the Rainbow, you're going to hear real rubato, because, or a lot of pop and jazz singers do rubato in which they are truly coming in and out of the frame of the orchestra. They get way ahead or way behind on a note. You know, I mean, no singer would sing Moon River. And they're just all over the place. They'll come early, they'll come late. So, now back to Mozart. That's too big a question. I have to do a separate thesis on that. In Chopin, the next nocturne in that opus, which I'll play, has a beautiful bass, which is very even, has this beautiful Bellini-like melody above it. And I don't know how you're supposed to play that, because for example, if you hear Joseph Hoffman's old recording of it, especially at the beginning of the piece, he's almost giving you a lecture and keeping that left hand amazingly unsentimental. It's almost so clear-eyed you can't stand it. As the piece develops, he gets a little bit less clear-eyed and a little bit more, shall we say, full of sentiment. It sounds amazingly modern to hear him play that, whereas many people will moon over it. I think perhaps, oh gosh, I don't know what rubato is, but what I don't like to hear, and I'll give a bad imitation of it, is when everything gets seasick in a rubato. I mean, it's sort of like everything is at sixes and sevens, and nothing has any shape or structure. But perhaps that's the question. I guess my word of the day is tolerances. I was using it about recording sessions. It's a series of what are your tolerances on a given thing. I mean, Moscheles talks about how when he listens to Chopin play, it's not like this, you know, this unhealthy, unstructured rhythm. It has this, he describes something which to me it implies. It's kind of hard. That was a really bad example of bad rubato, too. I don't know how to do it that.
I've heard things like that, yeah, as I think, you know, we all have.
And I think a lot of good musicians hated that in the 19th century, because Chopin and that style of salon playing became a license just to sort of, you know, not... It became licentious. I mean, it became only self-indulgence, you know. Mm. And yet, of course, if we played this sort of... of course, I don't know what great composer should be played strictly in a mechanical way. There are very few. Well, here's a great composer who is a bit more mechanistic. Stravinsky. I mean, if you play this... If you pinged each one of those out... Stravinsky would probably say, but you wouldn't do that, you know? it has to have a certain flexibility within a certain frame. There are many ways for the pianist to think of that. For example, there are six beats in this bar. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. But there are two large beats. 1, 2. 1, 2. And with playing with those different layers of rhythm in your consciousness as you play, you can describe all sorts of flexibilities. And it's a fun subject, by the way.
André Gide wants you to bring out the top, the offbeat.
He points out, Gide did a brilliant thing. He points out something which is very characteristic of Chopin's accompaniments. It's the way that Chopin will repeat certain notes in a chord. If this were an earlier piece, going back to the late 18th century, it wouldn't have been spread out. It would probably have been... And you say, oh, it's a piece by, you know, Dussek or somebody. Chopin not only spread it out and used the pedal, but he actually reiterated the third of the chord, which harmonically picks up the fundamental, the bottom note as well, but that's overtone series. And it creates kind of a magical vibration. I just brought it out subtly there. I'll bring it out less subtly. Now, why does Gide like that so much? Because it prefigures the entrance of the melody, so you don't even have to bring out that after you. It's just there in the texture. Chopin has this way of repeating certain notes, which makes the piano ring in a very free and unencumbered way. It's hard to explain it, but it sets the whole instrument ringing, not being loud. It just gives it a kind of a breath, a freedom. And that's one of the miraculous things about Chopin. And other composers learned this. Liszt certainly had a good deal of this quality, too. Brahms learned a lot about it from Chopin. Schumann was more awkward with it. Just finding things that make the piano breathe and sound alive. And that was one of the greatest things about him.
You're listening to pianist Garrick Olson live in the KPFA Performance Studio. Thank you to Jim Bennett for engineering this interview. My name is Sarah Cahill, and you're listening to KPFA or KPFB in Berkeley, KFC.